So the purpose of our session is really just to review some of the recent scholarship, to lay the groundwork for discussions later in the day, because we want you all to, probably many of you are familiar with this, but we want to lay the groundwork so that everybody can talk about it and tie it in with things that happen later in the day. We also want to equip you with things you can take with you. Anne Marie always already mentioned the book sales. We'll have a book list in your packet that Dr. Karras put together. And we ask you to share and discuss this in your parish when you get home. So just a little orientation to start off with. We're, of course, going quite a bit back in time. We'll look a little bit at some biblical material, some sub-apostolic material, but a lot of our discussion is going to come from the early Byzantine period, the patristic period, especially the 4th through 7th centuries. There'll be some things from the ecumenical councils, some of the early church manuals, the saints' lives. There'll be a wide range of things we'll talk about. And the last part is just to get a little bit of perspective about, has to right into the mic, sorry about that. A little bit of perspective in terms of, just because we don't see these things now, doesn't mean that they didn't exist earlier in church history as part of the tradition. So we really are talking about reviving or rejuvenating something that existed for quite a while in the church, as you'll see. A little bit of orientation geographically. We are going back mostly talking about the Byzantine Empire. I know there are some people here from non-Byzantine churches, so that'll be great to hear from them as well. And this is just to orient you to the five major patriarchates, Antioch, Jerusalem, Alexandria, Constantinople, and Rome, so that you're oriented a bit. We wanted to put this in context, too, rather than jumping right into the diaconate. It's important to realize that there were a number of consecrated roles for women in the early church. Women, of course, were doing other things as well that were not particularly consecrated roles, but like leading house churches, missionaries, all sorts of things. But you also have these consecrated roles, some of which had occasional liturgical elements to them. And we're just going to briefly mention a few of these before we go into the I'm not good at holding it too high. The consecrated virgins, for example, had special seating in the church, chanted, may have been involved in certain kinds of prayer commemorations. Nuns, of course, not only in their own cloistered setting, where, of course, the seclusion requires a greater deal of liturgical activity, which is something we'll return to several times, but also sometimes in urban churches as well. One of the other very common consecrated orders in the early church was the widows, and this has a lot of overlap with the deaconess. We see this in 1 Timothy. There's a kind of order in which the church supports these women in exchange for prayer and service. They do things like counseling younger women, assisting at baptism, which is one of the things you see with the women deacons. Their minimum age usually is 60, married only once, good reputation. So we see them in a number of sources. And you can see, for example, they overlapped for a while with the deaconess as well. I think the imagery in this passage is particularly interesting. The bishop sits for you in the place of God Almighty, but the deacon stands in the place of Christ. And the deaconess shall be honored by you in the place of the Holy Spirit, and the presbyters shall be to you in the likeness of the apostles, and the orphans and widows shall be reckoned by you in the likeness of the altar. And this may be tied to their vocation of constant prayer for the church. They were exhorted to pray, especially during the night and during particular special seasons of the church. So, one last group that we wanted to mention, Dr. Karras has written a very interesting article on these myrrh bearers, because they had such an interesting liturgical role. They're from the Middle Byzantine period. They're in Jerusalem at the Holy Sepulchre. And they had very particular functions, particularly at Easter time during the Paschal services. For example, during Easter matins, they chanted. They would sense the patriarch at the tomb. They would carry liturgical items in procession, like the triskelion. And they would sense during the gospel reading and then also enter the sepulchre and sense the Holy Sepulchre. So kind of an interesting, somewhat unusual liturgical function, very interesting order. And we can certainly refer you to her article about that if you'd like to read it. And without further ado then, I would like to turn things over to Dr. Karas, and see a wonderful example there that she found in Greece of processional incense bearers. And Dr. Karas is going to talk about the actual women deacons.
Thank you. Thank you. I wanted to just briefly mention some of the scholarship that's occurred in the modern period on the order of ordained deaconesses. We see that it begins in the second half of the 19th century and the early 20th century with a couple of works by, I believe that Pankowski was Polish, but the first real work was Karlsbach. And I think that because Evangelos Theodorou did his doctoral work in Germany, that is probably where he ran across that work. And then he furthered that and did his doctoral dissertation on the ordination of the female deacon. And that's why you see, for those of you who don't read Greek, the title Ihirotonia Ihirothesioton Diakonison means the ordination or however you want to term it, tonsuring, consecration, blessing of the deaconess. And he published that in three parts in the Greek theological journal Theologia, Theology. And then we see nothing more, and it's interesting how we've got sort of several decades between these works early on. But in the 70s, we see two Catholic theologians and historical scholars. Roger Grisson, I know it looks like Roger Grison, but he was actually French, so it was Roger Grisson, and the Italian scholar, Cipriano Vagagini, both published work just a couple of years apart on women in the early church, and specifically Grisson's, although it's broader, it includes a section on the female diaconate, and of course then Vagagini's work is specifically on the female diaconate, an article that he published in Orientalia Christiana Periodica. About 10 years later, Aimé Georges Martimor, another French Catholic theologian, published this immense work on deaconesses that is I have listed in the book list. It's a very good resource because he's really gathered texts that deal with the deaconess from all over the early and medieval Christian world. His analysis of those texts is lacking. Severely lacking at times because of his own preconception that women could never possibly have been ordained to any of the three major orders of deacon, priest, slash presbyter, or bishop. And so he refuses to acknowledge the significance of some of the things that he's got even in his own book in terms of the sources. And then more recently we see Kula Fitzgerald's, Kyriaki Karadoyanis Fitzgerald's book, which is very important, Women Deacons in the Orthodox Church, because she provides both a review of that of all of this historical research and brings out in particular Evangelos Theodorou's work, which had been largely inaccessible to anybody who doesn't read Greek. And she talks about the current situation and what might be done and what are the needs of the church today. And then, of course, Phyllis Zagano, who will be responding to our talk, looking at this in particular from the perspective of the Roman Catholic Church. In terms of ordained female deacons, we see evidence certainly of the female diaconate from the New Testament itself, and not only Romans 16:1, but also 1 Timothy 3, and how those are interpreted by early Christian scholars such as Origen and St. John Chrysostom, and then of course the 3rd and 4th, 5th century church manuals, these early church orders that deal with a variety of issues of church discipline. The Didascali Apostolorum, Apostolic Constitutions, Testamentum Domini. The Apostolic Constitutions is actually the first document that we have. It's a 4th century that provides the ordination rites for these orders and includes the ordination rite for the deaconess. And then we have a variety of other sources that refer to women deacons. They do seem to have been related to the widows. You'll see with the eligibility requirements, they are basically the same as those for the widows, but the widows die out and the deaconesses continue. And we see also that in the early church, they served primarily in parishes. I mean, parish is kind of a more modern term, but they served in church communities. But later we see that they move predominantly into the monasteries, and it becomes really sort of an exclusively monastic office. Why did the early church have ordained women serving in one of the major orders of clergy? I think that we can see that it comes out of this pastoral imperative to serve the needs of the women faithful in the church, and that those needs could not be filled exclusively by male clergy. And a lot of that has to do with the culture of that time, with the segregation of the sexes and the seclusion of women, that many times they were not to be in public at all. And so we see that women were able to minister to them in ways that men were not. I would also say that these issues are not irrelevant today. We'll see that one of the functions, for instance, of the deaconess, according to the Apostolic Constitutions, is to serve basically as a chaperone whenever a female parishioner needs to meet with a male clergyman, whether it's a deacon or anybody up to the bishop. And when we look at the issues of clergy sexual misconduct today, I know it's the abuse of children that gets the most headlines, but by far the most common form of clergy sexual misconduct in any church, not Orthodox alone, but all churches, all religions, is male clergy engaging in sexual relations with female parishioners. If you have female clergy who can counsel these women and who serve as chaperones when they meet with clergy, you don't have the he said, she said issue and the trauma that these women go through afterwards. So what were the functions of female deacons in the early and medieval church, Byzantine church? One of the most important on a liturgical level is that they assisted with the baptism of adult women. Because in the early church, all people, not just little babies as we do today, but all people of whatever age were baptized in the nude. It was part of the important symbolism of baptism being death and rebirth. And so not only were they baptized in the nude, but they were anointed with oil all over their bodies. And I think you can see, if you think about it, the problems that would develop of having some middle-aged male bishop rubbing oil all over the nude body of some young woman. So you have female deacons who perform that anointing and do the physical act of baptism, and then the bishop would, and it was always the bishop in the early church. Presbyters did not do baptisms because there was one bishop in every community, and he was the head. And so it was the bishop then who would actually read the prayers over that person after they had been suitably attired. This is also why, if you see in a document like the Apostolic Constitutions, that while there is a chastisement against deacons, either male or female, performing baptisms, you see a second one specifically against deaconesses doing it. And you can understand why that would be, because when male deacons were assisting the bishop was there, right, with the male convert who was being baptized. When the female deacon was assisting the bishop with the baptism of a female convert, the bishop was not physically present, and you could see how people would start to think that it was actually the female deacon who was performing the baptism. You see, as I mentioned before, the chaperoning function. They kept order in the women's section of the church. The sexes were segregated. If some of you have gone to Greece and Russia, you'll see that most of the churches to this day, and in the Middle East, are often segregated, with men on the south side of the church and women on the north side. And that's even mimicked in the iconography in the church decoration pattern. We have from Anthony of Novgorod that deaconesses were chanting the matin service at Dia Sophia, at the great church in Constantinople. He doesn't call them that. He calls them myrrh-bearers. But another scholar, George Majeska, pointed out to me that he was convinced they were deaconesses because the Church of Russia didn't have deaconesses. So he just called them something that they did have, which was myrrh-bearers. And then we see they took the Eucharist to sick women in their homes and ministered to those. So we often see, in terms of the monastic communities, it's abbesses and the liturgical leaders, the choir directors, so to speak, of the monastic community are often ordained to the diaconate. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through this, but I just want to point out that we have several important ways of seeing in the ordination rite itself and in other related materials that the female deacon, specifically in the Byzantine church, was very clearly ranked with the male deacon as part of the what we today call the major orders of clergy. That distinction, hierotonia, hierothesia, was not systematically used in the early church, and even into the early to part of the middle Byzantine period. But the idea of that distinction is clear in the aspects of the ordination rite. Moreover, we see in some of Justinian's novels, novels not meaning, you know, mystery fiction or something like that, but meaning an addition to his law code. We see him using that word, the diakonos, as we saw in the earlier church manuals, for both male and female deacons. So sometimes the word diakonissa is used, but diakonissa can also mean the wife of a deacon. And so what we see more commonly used is the term diakonos, deacon, and the distinction is only through either the masculine or the feminine article. So it's by the grammatical gender of the article, the, that we know whether they're talking about a male or a female deacon. This also means that you cannot always assume that they're only talking about male deacons when they use the masculine plural, because that also means male and female. And he also, very significantly, in his novel six, his sixth novel, he includes female deacons in his rules for the ordinations of the major orders of clergy, whom he explicitly calls the ierosini, the priesthood in that broader sense of deacons, presbyters, and bishops. Then if we look at the ordination rite itself, we see that it includes the prayer that begins Ithia Charis, the divine grace. This is a prayer that is used for the in the ordinations of male of the major orders of clergy, but not of minor orders such as subdeacons and readers. And basically, the ordination rite is the same. I also found it significant when I looked at Gore's Evkhologion that the Evkhologion is a service order book. It gives the services for the divine liturgy, for ordination rites, for baptisms, things like that. There are a number of these that we have from the Byzantine period. In all but one of them that we have from anywhere, the ordination for the female deacon is always listed immediately after the male deacon, and why I say this is significant is that it occurs whether the order for each office is in descending or ascending order. In other words, if it's descending order, you start with the bishop, then you go to the presbyter, then you go to the deacon. The deaconess occurs after that, female deacon, subdeacon, etc. But even when it's in ascending order, starting with the lower orders and going up through, you know, reader and subdeacon, the next one is deacon with deaconess immediately, the female deacons immediately following. And in fact, in some of these Evkhologia, they don't even put in the whole rite. It simply says, it's done the same as for the male deacon except for, and it just lists, you know, the couple of differences. So clearly, the two were seen as being at the same level. If it was seen as being subordinate, then in those of ascending order, it would have come before the male deacons, but it does not. The eligibility requirements we see are about the same as for the widows, although they gradually lowered the age for female deacons from initially 60 to 40, and even then you see exceptions. So for instance, Olympias's, St. John Chrysostom's good friend, St. Olympias, was widowed very young, was from a wealthy, well-connected family, very active in the church, and she was ordained to the female diaconate at the age of 29. Obviously, one difference between the consecrated widows and the female deacons is that you didn't have to be widowed. You could be a virgin. But basically, you had to be unmarried. So we see that there is a difference from the male deacons there in that they have, because male deacons can be only 25, and they can be married. So we see that the female deacons are older and unmarried, and my interpretation of that is that they want women who they see as less sexualized, less whatever, as, you know, less threatening or apparently sexual in some way. And we also see that in the more severe penalties if they engage in misconduct, and specifically sexual misconduct. In other words, if they get married, run off with a guy, something like that. In the case of male deacons and of presbyters, the penalty is defrocking. In the case of female deacons, it is also defrocking, but in addition, their property is confiscated. Yeah. So it's simultaneously an example of a double standard, but also it shows the true clerical status and the significance that the church ascribed to the female diaconate. Now, you know, I'm not going to go into great detail on this, but we see that, as I mentioned before, the ordination rite is essentially the same. There are only two or three minor differences from the male deacons. One is that her orarion, the diaconal stole, is the bishop vests her with the diaconal stole in the same way as it's put on the same way as for the male subdeacon, not deacon. I think that actually has to do with the fact that the female deacon does not do petitions during the service. So if you look at a male deacon during the service, you know, he lifts up the end of his stole, one end of his stole, and as he's reciting the litany, they believe that he may have put the petitions on there initially. But if you think about when the male deacon is preparing for communion, normally you will see this occur during the Lord's Prayer, he changes the way he's wearing his diaconal stole, and he changes it to wear it the same way as the subdeacon. So the deaconess is vested with the stole in the same way that the deacon will be vested with it at that point when they're going to receive the Eucharist. And in fact, they need it that way, with both ends in front, because in those days, they did not hold the chalice or the paten with their bare hands. They covered their hands, and you can see this in frescoes and icons of showing the communion of the apostles, for instance, where they're covering their hands with the robes that they're wearing. So the deacons, both male and female, would cover their hands with, they would use the ends of their stole to do that. And she's not going to give the Eucharist to the public. She'll take it to women in their homes, but she's not going to give it in church. So instead of going out, she takes the chalice from the bishop, as does the male deacon, but instead of going out to give communion to the congregation, she puts it back onto the altar again. There's actually a third difference that I wasn't going to bring up, and since some of you may have seen this rather unscholarly posting on OCNet by Fathers Farley and Hatfield that makes a big deal out of the fact that she's not kneeling the way that the male deacon is. I think if you think about the visualization of a woman kneeling in front of a man, the male deacon, you can maybe figure out why maybe they wouldn't have thought of it in terms of propriety as a good thing to do for the female deacon to be kneeling at her ordination. So I don't think that's a very significant difference, given that the major stuff, such as the fact that it occurs during the liturgy at the same time as the male deacon's does, it occurs in the altar area, all those other aspects are the same. And here are the ordination prayers from the earliest Efcolorion that we have, the Barberini 336 codex, which is from the 8th century. And we see in this first ordination prayer the reference to the Theotokos, that the incarnation sanctified the female, and that women as well as men received the Holy Spirit. Call this servant to the work of the diaconate, etc. And the second prayer, interestingly, also, has an epiklesis, calling down the Holy Spirit. And if you notice it at the end, and as you gave the grace of your diaconate to Phoebe, whom you called to the work of ministry. So the church, and we see this also in the funerary steles that that are of early deacons, female deacons, that reference to Phoebe. So the early church and the Byzantine church continue to recognize Phoebe from Romans 16:1, Paul's mention of Phoebe, as being a deacon of the church. So I'm going to turn it back over to Karen. All right.
I get the pleasure of talking about the saints a little bit. There also, we know quite a bit about real women who were deacons too, or who were remembered as being deacons. For example, in the Matican and Osiak text that's in your packet, you can see that if you take a look at that book, they have nearly 100 women that they have some information about. And Dr. Fitzgerald has found 23 female saints on the Orthodox calendar who are generally considered to be deaconesses. So there's definitely a strong recognition here that these women played a strong role in the faith. Of course, we've already been talking about Phoebe, and I'm sure you all realize she's considered a deaconess, as we were just talking about. Here's the OCA Troparion to her. Very clearly, you were found worthy of the diaconate. Deaconess Phoebe, pray to Christ God. So sometimes in the modern world, we debate about what this may mean, but it's interesting that in the patristic tradition, they took it to mean that she was a deaconess, just like the ones they saw around them in their daily lives. So for instance, Chrysostom says, see how much Paul distinguishes her. He mentions her before the others, calls her sister, and he adds to her status by calling her deacon. And we see the same kind of interpretation when Chrysostom looks at 1 Timothy. The debate there is over those lines. They're giving the requirements for the male deacon, and then they say, likewise, women must be modest, not slanderers, sober and faithful in every way. And the question then is whether that refers to the wives of deacons or to female deacons themselves. And Chrysostom comes down on the side of saying they are deacons. He says, why would he put something about women in general in the middle of the passage? He's speaking of women who hold the rank of deacon. So you can see in his interpretation of these texts that he very clearly thinks this. We also have these, what Dr. Fitzgerald calls the clerical families of the fourth century. These are well-connected families in which there are famous, highly ranked clerical men, and the women also seem to share in that status, or at least the church has traditionally considered them as deacons. For example, you have Nona, who's the mother of Gregory the theologian, married to the elder Gregory Nazianzus, and of course their two children then, one was Gregory the theologian and the other was Gorgonia, who's believed to be a deaconess. Similar situation with Gregory of Nyssa and Theosebia, and possibly his sister Macrina as well. So what may be going on here is that it may not have been unusual for highly ranked families to have female members also ordained. So for instance, at the Quinisext Council, you get this rule about what happens when a man becomes a bishop and he's already married. The wife goes by mutual consent to a monastery, and then you can see if she's deemed worthy, she may be advanced to the dignity of a deaconess. So there may be a kind of honorary position in some ways going on here. You've already heard Olympias mentioned a couple of times this morning. She's certainly a very famous example. And as you heard, she was ordained unusually early, probably due to her elite family status. She was a very strict ascetic, and from her enormous fortune, gave tremendously not only to the poor, but to visiting clergy, and to all sorts of church issues and functions, and of course was a close friend of John Chrysostom. She, interestingly enough, we know John Chrysostom also ordained some other women from her monastery. You can see here, he also ordained deacons of the Holy Church, her three relatives, Elisanthia, Martyria, and Palladia for the monastery, so that by the four diaconal services, the established procedure might be carried on by them, unbroken and without interruption. We don't know exactly what that means, but it seems to maybe imply that they need several women to lead some kind of all-night vigil, or perhaps the liturgy of the hours through the night. And of course, he always addresses her as a deaconess in his letters. There are also some interesting accounts of deaconesses who appear in saints' lives, who aren't themselves saints. I just thought I'd share one with you. You probably all know the story of Pelagia. It's one of those repentant harlot stories. But what's interesting in this context is that when she comes and decides to join the church, she is sponsored by a deaconess, Romana, and that woman seems to take charge of her catechumen education and takes her from the baptismal font. And after baptism, she stayed with Romana for a while. When she had that vision of the devil, Romana called for the bishop, so again, acting as that kind of intermediary. And they clearly developed a close relationship. She cried when Pelagia finally ran away to the male monastery to live in disguise. But I just thought this was a very interesting story because it shows just this kind of relationship that these two women built out of the diaconal service that Romana was doing for her. And it did strike me that this is an interesting model. Even now, I mean, there are many young women who are in trouble and have very difficult lives and could certainly benefit from guidance and counsel from an older, more mature woman who was properly trained for it. There are also other cases where they pop up in saints' lives. Like, for example, they're witnesses to a woman's identity in the life of Susanna. Of course, I wanted to mention Irene, who's such a fascinating story. And St. Irene was a beautiful young woman who was actually considered as a bride for the emperor, but then ended up joining a convent and became renowned for her extreme asceticism and her piety. When the abbess died, she wanted to appoint Irene, and so they went to consult Methodius, who was a confessor during iconoclasm. And Methodius immediately saw that she was the right person for the job. And in the life, it tells us, without delay, the patriarch rose from his throne at once, asked for a censer. Burning incense and praising God, he initiated a hymn befitting the occasion. And he first ordained Irene deaconess of the great church, for through the spirit in him he knew her purity, and thereafter consecrated her with the seal of the Higumenate. So it's an interesting account, because you can see that ordination to the diaconate comes first before becoming abbess of the monastery. And this seems to be fairly common, that abbesses or another woman in the monastery will be appointed as a deacon. And of course, the reasons for that are probably fairly clear. They're more secluded. They need people on hand who can carry out these duties. Of course, Irene was noted for her spiritual direction, her clairvoyance, and I believe spiritual direction is one of our topics this afternoon, so I'm looking forward to hearing that. And I would just suggest that there are a lot of things we can learn from looking at these women's lives. Many of them are, of course, from prominent families, the ones we know about, but we also have more obscure women we only know from grave inscriptions, things like that. And it does make you wonder who they were and what their lives were. Often their families will put that they were a deaconess on their tombstone. Clearly, it's linked to positions of authority. Deaconesses were the only ordained office for women, so that makes sense. Abbesses or people close to the abbess, often in clerical families, they were very commonly ordained in those contexts, but there are also clearly lots of other less well-known women who were serving as well. Clearly the charitable work stands out, but there are a lot of other roles you see here as well in terms of prayer, spiritual direction, the intermediaries with the bishop, the scholarship in some cases, like Gorgonio is renowned for her scholarship, Macrina, and also administration and the other forms of charitable outreach. So let me then hand this over to Valerie. She's going to talk about why this fell into disuse.
Well, I'm going to suggest some ideas for why it may have. We actually don't know why. We just know that we see first that shift into the monastic communities exclusively, and then fewer references, and then eventually no more references. So here are a few different reasons that there may have been. But the one reason that is explicitly given in texts from around the 12th through the 14th, 15th century by people like the canonist Theodore Balsamon and Matthew Vlastodes is this idea of ritual impurity, that that women's menstrual cycle somehow makes them unable to serve at the altar. And what I wanted to point out here is that there are two major trends that we see in the early church attitudes, theological flows about this notion. One is the one that's unfortunately eventually going to take over, which is out of the Church of Alexandria, but the other one is out of the Syrian church, out of the Church of Antioch. And we see in a variety of sources, both early church manuals that come out of the Church of Antioch, namely the Didascalia Apostolorum and the Apostolic Constitution, that they speak explicitly against the idea that menstruation, or for that matter, or childbirth, or any other kind of natural physical activity or condition. None of that makes a person impure. And St. John Chrysostom also speaks in the same way. So we see a very consistent attitude against this idea of ritual impurity in the Church of Antioch, and that, and interestingly, more recently, we see that in a decision of the Synod of the Church of Antioch in 1997, saying that, you know, we're getting rid of this idea of ritual impurity. So it may have had to do, in part, with a more polemical stance of the early Christian Church against Judaism in that area. Unfortunately, a different attitude develops in the Church of Alexandria, and we see this from Dionysius of Alexandria on. But what's interesting also about this is that not only do they say that this idea of ritual impurity applies to women who are menstruous, and that therefore not only should they not take communion, but should not even enter into the church, but these Byzantine canonists, like Matthew Vlastides, are doing cartwheels explaining why the idea of ritual impurity does not apply to men with nocturnal emissions. Right. So they are not under this because we're no longer under the law, and this is not something voluntary, as though women are willingly choosing to bleed for a week every month. The problem is that those canonical letters of Dionysius and Timothy of Alexandria make their way into the general series of canons in the early church through that Quinisext Council, the Council in Trullo, because it simply takes en masse about 200 of these canonical letters by people like Dionysius, Basil the Great, others. As well, I did want to mention one thing. I'm going to go back for a second here to Dionysius's. If you look at the middle, because our gospel reading, one of our gospel readings today, was a woman who had the issue of blood. All right, so Dionysius is saying, notice she wouldn't even dare to touch his garment itself, but only the fringe of his garment. He's writing in the middle of the 3rd century. At that same time, the middle of the 3rd century. In the Didaska, which is the time period of the writing of the Didaskali Apostolorum, the teaching of the apostles, this early church manual. That document, the Didaskalia, cites the same passage and draws the opposite conclusion. Says, notice that even though she's menstruous, she dares to touch the fringe of his garment. So, you know, things are not always self-evident. Interpretations are not always the same for any two people. So, the Quinisext Council, 691-692, the end of the 7th century, we start seeing in the 8th and 9th century, well, really more in the 9th century, we start seeing this idea of ritual impurity in documents, in writers, within the Byzantine Church. So, in the Euphiloion, the Barberini one, that earliest one that we have, which is actually from the 8th century, the 40-day blessing for the child is just that. There's just one prayer for the child. No mention of the mother. You look a few centuries later, and you see that it's turned all the way upside down. And you've got, it's named for the mother, there's two prayers for the mother, there's all this discussion about her being impure. And you see the same kind of attitude in some of the canonical letters of Patriarch Nicephorus, who apparently had no connection with reality because he thought that if a child was baptized at sort of an emergency baptism before the 40 days, that they needed to bring in somebody else to breastfeed the child because he shouldn't be touched by the mother. And here, what I mentioned before, the canonists and their idea about that. I'll just point out that I want to know how Theodore Balsamon knew that these women were menstruating when he complains about women menstruating. And he says, and who are the worst? It's the nuns. How dare them go to church? So We start seeing a revival of both an ordained and consecrated diaconate starting around the middle of the 19th century. Early on, we see that the Armenian Apostolic Church has this, and they in the modern period, in the 19th century and into the 20th century, they have a very strong, fully ordained female diaconate. And here is a photo, actually, of a fully ordained, fully vested Armenian deaconess holding the liturgical fan. And then we see, I think that's the root of the discussion that begins in the Church of Russia and perhaps for St. Nectarios, who ordained several of the women in the women's monastery that he founded on Aegina, to the diaconate, because it's occurring at this time period that you have a very active female diaconate within the Armenian Apostolic Church in Jerusalem, in particular. So you see these discussions and even actions by St. Nectarios himself, who interestingly tries to downplay it later because there's controversy about it in the Church of Greece. And so he says, well, they're really more like subdeacons. But he had them doing petitions in the monastery, which women, the deacons in the Byzantine period, the female deacons, did not do. Also in the modern Coptic Church, there's a very active female diaconate, although it's consecrated, not ordained. So we see that there were actually a variety of different ordained and consecrated women's orders in the early and Byzantine / medieval periods, and that the female diaconate was one of the most important of those orders, and that their ministry was both pastoral and diaconal. We see that there were a number of saints in the church who were female deacons. There were more who were clearly not female deacons according to the materials, the documents from that time, but who the church later ascribed to have been deacons, I think, out of this idea of honoring them, that they were among the three major orders of clergy. They were ranked with the male deacons, but with a more limited ministry that that coincided with that cultural idea of women having the private sphere as opposed to the public sphere. I think they probably died out because of the rise of this idea of ritual impurity and the fact that we didn't see deaconesses so much in communities anymore because they were in women's monasteries. And then we see that there's been a return of the diaconate in some of the non-Chalcedonian churches and discussion for the past century and a half or so about the restoration of the ordained female diaconate within the Eastern Orthodox churches. Thank you.
I want to thank you all, and particularly Dr. Karas and Dr. Steyer, for this wonderful presentation. You know, history isn't everything, isn't the only thing, you know, but it's everything. It's everything. Really appreciate being here. It becomes a wonderful opportunity at ecumenism for all of us. I'll just point out to you, I have to leave at 2:30. With me in the back, I have three more RCs. I have Sister Irene Kelly, Dr. Carmela Leonforte, and Sarah Esteban. And if you have any questions and you can't find me, please find them, particularly Dr. Leonforte, who is learning Greek, as am I, and you can help us proofread what we're doing. I certainly can't respond to everything that's been said in this wonderful presentation. I can say a few things. One, in terms of the ecumenical nature of the discussion, I'll tell you a couple of stories. A couple of years ago, Cardinal O'Malley, Sean O'Malley, the Archbishop of Boston, was approached by a major donor, a woman, of his archdiocese, who said, you know, Cardinal O'Malley, the diaconate for women is a real thing, and we really need to think about it, to talk about it. And he said, well, you know, we can't get ahead of the Orthodox on this. And then some years later, another woman, a major donor, actually a major scholar, approached His All Holiness Bartholomew and said, you know, Holiness, we must return to the wonderful tradition in our church of women as deacons. And Bartholomew said, you know, we can't get ahead of the Romans on this. So I think it's a good thing that we're all in here together. Let me just say a few things about the presentation. I've done a lot of work on, certainly on the Greek church, and one of the problems I find when I discuss this today with Romans is the terminology. And so, at least in Roman Catholic dialogue, we have been able to argue that when it is diakonos with the feminine article, it's woman deacon or deacon. And when it's diakonissia, it is deaconess. And then by that, I will then go further and say today, when I say deacon or woman deacon, I mean someone who is ordained. And the reason for that is we have people such as Cardinal Casper and some other people who are influential in Rome saying, well, we can have deaconesses and they can dress up and they can have certain roles in the liturgy, but we don't want to ordain them. Okay, because, you know, we don't do that. And that's where I would come to the further discussion of terminology. We find in the histories, and there are many, Carlsbach, yes, is the beginning. There is also a, and I can't think of his name now, a 17th century collation of documents. But Carlsbach and then Josephine Mayer in 1938 each gather together the various documents, the various findings we have in literature, in liturgy, and in canon law. And we find three things going on. We find consecration, we find blessing, and we find ordination. And for me, I look for ordination, and you will find that deaconesses are ordained, and this is where Evangelist Teodoro comes in, and he will very clearly distinguish between what is a blessing and what is an ordination. Won't recite the entire history that you just heard, but I think it's important to recognize that certainly in the tradition of the Eastern churches, we will have presbytera, we have deaconesses, and many times these are the wives of clergy. In fact, when a man would become, in some Eastern churches, perhaps your own, when a man would become a bishop, he would leave his wife and she would become ordained or consecrated or blessed as a deaconess, but they would live apart. So I just remind you, the term that certainly I use in the Roman discussions is ordination. That's what I look for. And I'm just coming from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops meeting in Baltimore. They meet every year. And some very interesting conversations. But in talking with the bishops of the Eastern churches, they said the key is to look into the rituals and look for the epiclesis. If you've got an epiclesis, you've got an ordination, period. And they can't argue you out of that. I often say, you know, and some of my opponents say, and I characterize what they say or caricaturize what they say, that if in an epiclesis the bishop has laid his hands on and has called down the blessing of the Holy Spirit on the woman, and the Holy Spirit says, I can't do it, it's a girl. And I would not expect this kind of a response of the triune God. So, nor would I actually determine and retrospectively decide that the bishop didn't mean to do what he did. I think it's quite unfortunate when we have that evolution. So let me tell you where the discussion is today. Very interesting things have been happening this year. Just going back to the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, Cardinal DiNardo of Galveston, Houston, who is a patristic scholar, saw me with my name tag around my chest and said, "Phyllis Deakins, Phyllis Deakins, Phyllis Deakins." And then he started talking in Greek to me. But before that, I was invited by Cardinal Archbishop Charles Chaput of Philadelphia to his seminary to debate Sister Sarah Butler. Sister Butler was really one of the first women appointed to the International Theological Commission. The International Theological Commission is a part of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the old Holy Office, and for 10 years she was on that commission. I'll talk a little bit more about what they did, but I was invited to Philadelphia to discuss in front of 150 seminarians, all the deacon candidates, their wives, and whoever else could sneak in, to discuss and have a debate on the ordination of women to the diaconate. Sister Butler uses basically two arguments against me, and she gets these arguments from Marie Mort. Okay? Marie Mort is one of the scholars who was mentioned. He wrote in response to Grison, and in response to the discussion in the 70s about restoring women to the ordained diaconate in the Catholic churches. And we have to remember that. There are 22 Catholic churches. There's a Greek Catholic Church, there's a Russian Catholic Church, there's a Ukrainian Catholic Church, there's a Ruthenian Catholic Church, there's Melkite, there are many Syro-Malabar, Maronite. There are many Catholic churches. And I know enough not to use the word uniate, but the fact is that that these churches have come and they have accepted the primacy of Rome. We mentioned some of the patriarchies here, Antioch, Alexandria. We didn't mention Jerusalem, Constantinople, and Rome. And you know what happened in 1054. And it's an unfortunate split between us that I think the Holy Father, Pope Francis, is attempting to heal. Because Francis knows, as any well-educated Catholic knows, you are our seniors. And if I find a Greek guy, I get married in his church, not in the Roman church. And that is Catholic canon law, that we bow to the tradition of our older siblings. And but in Philadelphia, Sister Butler used two basic arguments. One, and this is directly from the International Theological Commission's 2002 document on the diaconate, one, that women deacons are different because the rituals used are different. Well, that may or may not be true. The ritual she used is the only one she found in the Apostolic Constitution, which was then copied by two others. And she didn't go to the Greco-Byzantine 336, nor did she go to the documents from Grotta Ferrata, where it's clear that is the same ordination ceremony for a male deacon and for a female deacon. The other way Sister Butler distinguishes is on the roles. She said that women deacons did not have, and I love it because I've gotten her to say women deacons now, that women deacons didn't do the same thing as male deacons. Well, you know, she said, well, women deacons ministered only to women. And of course, my rejoinder is, well, who ministers to women now? Such as Dr. Karras pointed out, if you want to talk about sex abuse, I'm here. I mean, there's a lot of it. But I remember a Syrian bishop in the 5th century, and I got this from Josephine Mayer. He uses a very interesting verb when he talks about why you need a woman deacon. He says it's unseemly for a woman to unclothe herself, obviously in confirmation, and also we didn't talk about extreme unction, for the anointing. But the verb means also to disclose herself. It's unseemly for a woman to disclose herself before a man. Now, before a man alone, that is the woman deacon chaperoning her, or simply before a man? Well, there is a lot of ministry done by women. And I say this to bishops and cardinals all the time. When my spiritual director blesses me, it's not your blessing, cardinal. It's not connected directly to your church because she's not ordained. When a woman is ministering, okay, as an employee of your diocese or archdiocese, she is doing that, but she is not connected in the way the clergy are. So here's your choice. You can either train, ordain, and give faculties to the women who are working for you, or not. Those are your choices. Either you will control, and they love that word, you will control the teaching, or you don't. What is your job, Bishop? What is your job, Archbishop? What is your job, Cardinal? But to maintain the deposit of faith and to pass it on to the people. And how do you do that? You do that by having clergy who are members of your household, who are members of your household, okay, who will carry the word forth. Okay? So, we have a lot of scholarship. Dr. Karras mentioned some of it. The book I'm more known for is Holy Saturday, which is in 2000, and it's an argument for the restoration of the diaconate, and the female diaconate in the Catholic Church, which was outlined for me in collaboration with John Cardinal O'Connor, for whom I worked at the time, and who challenged me. He said, if you write a good book, I'll get it to the Pope. I said, oh, you're full of it. You don't know the Pope. And he knew him. And at one point, he told me in the 90s, there's a big problem in Rome. And the problem in Rome is, for 20 years that I know of, they can't figure out how to ordain a woman as deacon without saying, well, it's okay to ordain a woman as priest. And I said, well, Cardinal O'Connor, I'm not allowed to talk about women priests. Why are you bringing that up? He said, oh, that's a very good point. Make that chapter 4. So there's a whole chapter in Holy Saturday, which unfortunately I didn't bring today, about that. But I do have other stuff. And the other works, some of which are in the back, one of which I'd like to point out to you because we just published it, is The Ordination of Women to the Diaconate in the Eastern Churches, which is the essay by Cipriano Vagagini that was written in 1972 at the request of Pope Paul VI as the diaconate was being reintroduced as a permanent vocation in the Roman Catholic Church, or in the Catholic Churches. And it was written for the International Theological Commission but never appeared as a document. So in 1974, Robert Taft of the Society of Jesus published it as editor of Orientalia Christiana Periodica. So we translated this, Dr. Leonforte and I, with a little bit of help. And there's also in this a small essay, which is almost better. It's Vagagini's 1987 intervention before the 1987 Synod of Bishops. And that is a précis of the longer article, which is half in Greek, but you don't care about that. You can understand what's going on. And then the other two back there are Women in Ministry, which was on the board here, and Women Deacons, Past, Present, and Future. The Gary Macy essay in this gives a lot of your history, because really that's the history. But I will tell you that when the Vatican does the research, they're very selective. And we found a footnote which mentioned a couple of people, certainly Vagagini, but Corrado Marucci, Della Haye, Yves Congar. So right now what I'm doing is preparing translations of some of these, and we'll be putting them out with the liturgical press as they did, as we did with the Vagagini book. Every bishop, every Catholic bishop in the United States has received the Vagagini book, which is why they were running up to me going, Phyllis Deacons. But I think that, you know, the scholarship needs to go on. I gave an online seminar last summer. I had 300 people on 5 continents discussing this, and the history is really your history. As I was listening, I was thinking, I know later in the day you're going to have, what can we do, what should we do? I met with a priest on Tuesday who was well-placed in the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. He said, op-eds, just keep the conversation going. If Father Farley and Father, who's the other one? Yeah, are writing against you, well, write back, you know. The liturgical year has just ended in Rome, and the very last reading in the Office of Readings for the day before the beginning of Lent is a reading from Augustine. and he talks about how workers on the road sing. And I was thinking of this as we sang this morning. Workers on the road sing, but they sing while they're working. And the final sentence is sing, 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 but keep on working. And I'd ask you to do that. And we'll pray for each other as we do try to argue in our respective churches that we are all made in the image and likeness of Christ, because that's our teaching, and that's what we hold. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.